Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Collins versus Isom Newsom.
May it please the court, Mr. John Martin will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, we are here today representing four professional educators employed by the Dallas Within School District who have been sued by another high-level administrator of the district court. Slander per se, and civil conspiracy. The defendants below pled the immunity defense provided by the Education Code. The trial court denied the application of immunity. That was appealed on an interlocutory basis to the Dallas School District. That court affirmed the denial of immunity, and the court is the petitioners are here still asserting their right to immunity. The only question involved here is one of scope. The other elements of the Education Code immunity have been met and are conceded to have gone away except the scope question.
But we do have a real good question of jurisdiction.
Well, I thought that had been resolved by the grant, but we're willing to take that up to your honor.
Good.
Good. I wasn't planning to try to talk you out of it, though.
No, I knew that. But you think it would be better for your argument to talk about the merits first and then go back and try to establish a conflict with...
The conflict is clear.
Some of your cases are unpublished, which we never really, that I can find, and granted a case based on a conflict with a case that nobody can cite.
But there's no reason not to, Your Honor. You're trying to get cases consistent. You're trying to make, you want justice in every case. An opinion is opinion. And, of course, there's a lot, there's some learning now.
But if you can't cite it in your brief, it's going to be kind of hard.
if you can't cite it, but it's still wrong. It shows the conflicts are there. It shows this need. If every court wrote in this area and never published an opinion, we would never have a consistent rule.
Would you tell us what published case you contend conflicts with the Court of Appeals decision in this
the,
case?
The Williams case.
And why does it conflict?
It applies the immunity as we say it should be applied, as this court applied in the Chambers case, a functional test that doesn't look at the intent or it doesn't look at the good faith element.
Well, but all the Court of Appeals held in this case was that the affidavits were conclusory and didn't meet the requirement under Rule 166A. So how does that create a conflict?
That's the basis for the
court's decision.
That is not all they held, Your Honor.
But isn't that the basis for the court's decision?
No, sir. The basis for the court's decision is first that there's other elements written into the Education Code, the elements of good faith which the legislature refused to write into them. And it reads the requirements. It's paragraph 4. I mean, it's a paragraph on page 4. I'd like to call the court's attention to that. This is where we contend that the court below made three errors. It says the Education Code provides little guidance for determining what acts are incident to or within the scope of the employee's duties. That, we say, is wrong, because the Education Code provides guidance. It says that there is no good faith element written into that provision, and it wrote in good faith in other instances. For example, in
But that's not a holding of the case that under our jurisprudence in which we determine when a conflict exists. How does that type of statement in this case mean that if it would overrule Williams?
Because if it held like Williams,
and that's not a holding in the case.
That is part of the court's analysis. It leads to the holding. If the court did not make that analysis,
applying the coastal test.
Yes.
Would you please tell me why there's a conflict applying the specific holding of Coastal to Williams in this case and tell us how the conflict is there?
The Williams case says that you don't look to any kind of subjective intent. You look to see if it was within the duties that they were generally required to perform. You look to those duties. You don't read in other elements. The court below read in the elements of you've got to have and show it. You were in good faith when you were doing what you were doing.
My problem here is ever drawing a line when a school official could do anything that would get them sued. How a school official could ever do anything as long as they were at work for which the law could hold them accountable. In some of these cases that you cite, like Chambers, we allow intentional torts to be covered, but there's a good faith element. There is some catch. There is some outer boundary beyond which, if you go, the law can hold you to task. And how you would have us structure this is we're not going to look at an intentional, non-intentional. You say the fact that Williams was not an intentional torter is important. And we're not going to have a good faith requirement because the statute doesn't have it. I mean, why didn't the legislature just write school officials need not worry about the courthouse because they'll never go there?
We believe if you read carefully the statute, it pretty much did that job. It says, one, we look at what school officials can do to hurt people. They can drive cars and hurt people. We won't give them immunity for that. They can also hurt kids when they're disciplined. We won't give them immunity for that. But otherwise, we're going to let them, as long as they're within the general scope of their duty.
So why is an intentional tort if it's committed within the scope of one's duty? Under what law, what law can you cite to us in which committing an intentional tort is ever within the scope of one's duty?
Well, the intentional tort, there are cases that say just because you've committed an intentional tort. The Barr versus Mateo case is an intentional tort. He slandered that that employee, Salazar, is an intentional tort. The court's facts say that the Salazar was specifically authorized to do what he did. Attorney General comes out and says in a press release, he wasn't ever authorized, and slandered him in his professional career as a lawyer. Like, you go off, that was an intentional tort. Immunity was applied there.
Well, this provision is only implicated if the action is the result of judgment or discretion. I don't know how it's not an intentional. I don't know how the statute doesn't apply to an intentional act on the part of the actor,
because
one of the elements to get the immunity is the act has to be the result of exercising discretion or judgment.
And conducting investigations, talking to the press, those things are what we did here. Now, what we're accused of in the affidavits, and this will be very specific when you look at this, and you're talking about intentional torts. Don't just say there's, an intentional tort, and close your eyes to what the allegations are. Here they're saying that they heard it in the newspapers. That's what Dr. Ison Newsom says. She heard television reports that she'd been slammed. Her other affiant, Matthew Harden, says, I was surprised to learn that Robbie Collins said something. That's all he said. And that's supposedly the intentional tort. That's supposedly the slander. And that doesn't, I mean, if you look at it, that's what they were doing in their job. And the point, I think, was made by the legislature in 1973 when they wrote this statute. I think they wrote it with Barr versus Mateo in mind. Just like the court in 1995 in Salazar said, Barr and Mateo start systems. This is where we come from. They said any act that's within scope and is though done with discretion is immune. And it says any act. It doesn't say an intentional act. It doesn't say a negligent act.
Well, Mr. Martin, so what is the test under the scope provision of the statute?
The test is whether it's within the general nature of the duties assigned to it. Just like Chambers, just like Mateo.
Regardless of whether in any way, even though it's within the scope, if it's done for their own interest as opposed to the interest
right.
of their employer. So if I were a teacher and it didn't benefit my school district to do this, but it benefited me personally, but because it was in the my general duties, then I get the immunity for my personal act as opposed to my act on behalf of the school district.
What kind of act would you be doing?
Is that right?
No, ma'am.
I just want to understand how
that
works.
If you go steal money from the cash register, that's your personal act. That's not part of your general duties.
Well, what if your general duties are cleaning up? Okay? You're responsible for cleaning up the classroom, and in the course of cleaning up the classroom, you totally destroy somebody's property on purpose because you're very angry at them. Or even worse, you physically injure somebody, you're moving desks around in a classroom, and you literally mow a child over because you're very angry at the child and you want to personally injure the child.
That's a little far-fetched, but I think the legislature determined that this is not going to happen in education.
Well,
hold on a second, because under the test you want us to apply, first of all, it's not far-fetched to have teachers get angry at students and want to personally take physical action against them because we'll read about it in the newspapers. So, assuming that happens, if a teacher decides to purposefully injure a child, what you're saying is that teacher has immunity.
No, I'm not at all, Your Honor.
Then tell me how consistent with the theory you are espousing that teacher could be subject to a lawsuit.
Well, injuring a child is not part of a teacher's duties. Now,
you're moving desk around the room.
Well, the other alternative was given to me at the Court of Appeals was that, you know, if you're said to keep order and you don't like somebody, you shoot him while you're keeping order, is that in your duties? Of course, those kind of outrageous situations aren't within the duties. But what was meant to be here was any act that is within this general nature of your duty. And we want to keep the educators out of the courtroom. That's what immunity is about.
Mr. Martin, the examples that Judge Abbott just gave you are the kinds of things that seems to me would result from your definition of stopping at is it within your duties? Because I could do something as a teacher that was within my duties that really was outside what anyone ever expected me to do or the district to do. The examples he gave, it seems to me, are what would result from what the test that you would have us apply. And I know you say, well, that's outrageous, it's not going to happen, but we have to be concerned about what the consequences of our decisions
are. The question of exercise of discretion, moving a desk around, I don't think you get to the situation of running over somebody is an exercise of discretion. I think the legislature clearly wrote that requirement in there, that certain acts, conducting investigations, talking to the press, that's all we did here.
Okay, well, now...
Do you disagree on page 34 of the respondent's brief with any of the hypotheticals they said would be immune under your test? Intentionally serving tainted food?
Yes, that would be exempt from the ticket. I'm going to put it the other way. You have to be a professional educator.
Okay.
First. So,
submitting false grades.
And I think that intentionally submitting false grades would come within immunity. Now, why? Because there are other things, there are other provisions in the educational code. They're professional educators. They can be stripped of their license. There are other things that the legislature was aware of in 1973 that when they put the whole educational code in place, it would take care of it.
Or the person injured would have no recourse. It may be fine to remove the teacher from that situation, but the person injured would be permanently damaged forever.
And the legislature made that decision. They thought it would be better for the school system of this state if there were no individual redress. And that's what these other immunity cases are about.
Or if teachers couldn't be sued over an argument over what grade they should be given.
That's right. It goes that far. And this is one of the cases, Stimson, a case that we disagree with. It's a conflict.
Mr. Martin, how many cases do we have to overrule to interpret the education code the way you would have us do, since the weight of authority seems to go against you?
I hadn't tried to count them up, but the two or three that come to mind are Stimson, Galeagos. Galeagos was one where they said a superintendent couldn't give information to the school board member.
Well, I understand. So how many? That's three. You can think of at least three. The weight of authority goes against you on this argument.
Well, ma'am, we've got several cases. We've got the most recent case that's been to supply conflict jurisdiction, but that Enrique's case is right with us.
And Enrique's does not provide conflict jurisdiction.
Ma'am?
You said Enrique does not.
No, it did not come before. It is directly opposed to the Dallas court. It just happened to come down later. It's not a prior decision.
But there are several cases that that are contrary to your position in terms of
interpreting
education.
A handful. The discussion is confusing. That's what the problem is.
Can you turn to the affidavits for just a minute? And looking at the affidavits, the Court of Appeals determined that the whole stack of affidavits that were submitted, that the affidavits were conclusory. And that is basically, that's the ultimate decision that the Court of Appeals reached and the basis for reversing.
The ultimate decision, yes, ma'am.
All right.
And they're wrong.
So why are these? Show us why these affidavits are not conclusory. Like looking at Mr. Collins' affidavit.
Mr. Collins says I conduct investigations. That's part of my job. And the Fifth Circuit.
Where does it say in his affidavit that he conducts? He says we are continually conducting investigations.
Yes, ma'am. He says he's heads an apartment, a department that's been doing that since 1983. Of that. Fifth Circuit case showed him having relating to the press. But Robert Johnston's affidavits with the attachments show the duties that the school district imposed on these people to meet with the press. Mr. Connick's job was to conduct investigations.
Most of the affidavits seem to be geared towards denying any wrongdoing.
No, ma'am, they are not at all. If you read them carefully, we did not think that fair. We could have had Mr. Collins say, I did not say that I slandered him. But that's not fair because they can't discover that. And that's not the issue. The issue is not whether he might have inadvertently or advertently said Dr. Eisen-Newsom wanted bathrooms when she shouldn't. I mean, that's what this comes down to.
So what paragraphs of the various affidavits do you contend meet the burden under the statute?
Then, if you read them all together, Dr. Gonzalez starts out saying she wanted an investigation to be held.
Okay.
And said for Robbie Collins to do, because he's her chief investigator. The people, the one guy that's in charge of the public relations department, Hinkle, was kind of out of the picture. In fact, he got sued in this case, and there's not anything that he did that you can see except being named in this lawsuit, that he should be in the suit. But he said, I turned over to John DeLander, reacting to the press. And here the press, DeLander's statement is very clear that the press started this. The press wanted to come in and look at the bill, bathrooms. They wanted to look at the open records. It was the press that was there, and John DeLander was trying to do his duty to control it. That's what he did. The only thing he is accused of in the petition of doing is conducting the press on the tour of the building. That's all he did to slander Gonzalez. And Collins, Peyton talked to the press, and he said, they asked him whose fault it was, and Peyton said, I had to talk to the press because I'm supposed to, and he said, I didn't say it was her fault. So they're none of them conclusory, and particularly if you add the non-named defendant, the secretary of the board, that sets out all of the duties and the powers there.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken. The court is ready to hear argument and respond.
May it please the court, Mr. Scott Hirschman will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I would like to make three brief points that I believe respond to what your questions that remain unanswered, and I also believe address all the issues that the counsel has raised. Point number one, this court can either deny jurisdiction or simply affirm an evidentiary ruling and go no further than that. That evidentiary ruling is that there was no competent summary judgment evidence negating as a matter of law every genuine issue of material fact as to whether the conduct complained of was within the scope of the defendant's authority. One thing that counsel was not able to point to was where in Mr. Collins' affidavit he said, and Mr. Collins is the person who allegedly made the defamatory statement, it's my job to talk to the press. It doesn't say that in there. And his affidavit can be found at 325-27 in the court record. Nor does it say in the written position description, which is at 383 attached to Mr. Johnson's affidavit, that it's Mr. Collins' job to speak to the press. Nor does it say in any other affidavit or any other evidence that was before the court that it was Mr. Collins' job, it was in the scope of his employment, to speak to the press.
One of the affidavits said that the press officer asked me to talk.
Correct. But simply someone asking you to do something doesn't mean that becomes automatically your job or that it was
within
the scope.
It's going to be a very hard place to work if people ask each other to do something, to say, well, no, I can't do it. It's not in my job description.
Respectfully, I think
325 of the record.
I believe that the DISC is structured just as like that, and I don't think that simply being asked to do something necessarily makes it within your job description. But even if it does, I believe there's a genuine issue of material fact as to whether being requested to do something pulls it within your description. What's important to note, though, is what evidence is here, because this case is unique in that, without the benefit of any discovery, we presented prima facie proof of intentional torts. And respectfully, all the other cases, whether they hold intentional torts are still within the scope, or whether they say no intentional torts can't be within the scope of one's employment, there is no evidence, nothing other than allegations, that there was something wrong committed. Here we have Mr. Harden's affidavit at 439-42 that says he, Mr. Collins, and others met, discussed the Eisen-Newsom matter, determined that she did nothing wrong, concluded their investigation, only to have Mr. Collins literally step from that meeting, have a press conference, and say, there's an ongoing investigation, looks like Eisen-Newsom did something wrong, and disciplinary action is forthcoming. That's puzzling by itself, but then when you add the fact that the testimony also was that Mr. Collins' boss was concerned about, Ms. Gonzalez was concerned about media attention to her, wanted to redirect that to Eisen-Newsom, and said, if I go down, I'm taking Eisen-Newsom with me. reasonable inferences can be made of conspiracy and wrongful conduct there, at a minimum.
Let me ask you about that. The statute that provides immunity is fairly clear, that if this is a function that's incident to their job and it involves the exercise of discretion or judgment, they have immunity, unless it involves discipline of a child or something to that nature. The argument that's made is the Dallas court applies a kind of a respondeat superior gloss to this, but respondeat superior has to do with negligence. It doesn't apply to intentional torts. This statute doesn't make a differentiation between negligence and intentional tort, but can you be negligent in the exercise? Can you commit a negligent act and that still be a discretionary act?
Yes, I believe that's the case. I think you commit a negligent act and still have that within the scope. And I think those are types of acts typically.
Isn't it as likely or more likely that the discretion is you determined to do an act, you intend to act, you just use faulty judgment in determining what act you're going to commit? Isn't it more likely that it was designed to protect administrators from a decision they make on how best to do their job?
Yes, as long.
And so respondeat superior doesn't really fit very well, because respondeat superior, one of its thresholds is that you're negligent, and therefore we want to make the employer liable because they must accept the risk that an employee doing their job will cause negligence, which is not an intention to do, not a judgment issue. It just simply is they are negligent in how they perform their function. This case says they could do it intentionally. We don't want them sued. How does respondeat superior help us evaluate whether or not immunity applies or doesn't apply?
Because it helps draw the bridge between whether you can hold the principal liable for the agent's actions. What we want to determine is, we're not trying to add here a good faith.
But discretion implies that they're acting on their own. Judgment implies they're acting on their own. You say, well, unless DISD said, Mr. Collins, you can talk to the press, then he's not immune. But he's immune if he's exercising his discretion, even if his discretion is wrong, which implies that he's exercising some function that he's not directed to do by his superior.
Your Honor, I agree with you, but my concern is that once he then decides to lie, intentionally lie, say something that is completely false to what was determined minutes before, then that is no longer within his scope, because he's not acting on behalf of DISD, for DISD, or his role as a DISD employee. We're not trying to add a good faith or intentional tort requirement to the statute. We're not saying one must act within the scope and act.
But you are arguing that puts some gloss on the discretion. You're saying that he can exercise discretion, which is independent of what he's assigned to do by his superior, otherwise it wouldn't be discretionary. But he can only exercise the discretion properly, meaning my discretion is I've got to go talk to the press. I've got to review. That's my duty. What I tell them may or may not be true. And you're saying if it's not true, then I don't have the discretion to talk to the press, and therefore I don't have immunity. So it basically depends on what you're able to prove as to whether or not immunity applies.
Respectfully, I believe if I understand it correctly, that's partially correct. And I think what we're saying is, if he tells the press something wrong, uses his discretion, and he just blows it because he was misspoke, that's probably within the scope of his employment. You're allowed to misspeak, make mistakes. But if you go to the press deciding one thing, absolving Ms. Isaac Newsom of wrongdoing, and then a minute later tell the press, not only is there no resolution here, but that you're implicating her wrongdoing and disciplinary action is going to follow, that's a completely different act.
Isn't that a good faith implication? In that you've got to exercise your discretion
with a proper purpose?
No. What it is we have to decide, and I think everyone in the court has touched on this, what does it mean to be within the scope? What is the test? It can't simply be, as a counsel would like, if it could be within the generic description of your job duties, it's within the scope, or else you get the what he claims are far-fetched possibilities. Well, but they aren't far-fetched. Nothing's far-fetched nowadays, respectfully. But things that even might be far-fetched are not.
Well, it won't take much for a plaintiff to allege that you didn't just misspeak. You should have known better than to say what you said.
Exactly. However,
so there won't be any immunity. You'll be in court every time.
Perhaps, but the plaintiff has to do more than that, because remember, the statutory scheme now is that you file suit, the defendants can immediately assert a summary judgment motion based on this one immunity, the plaintiff gets zero discovery, and the plaintiff must now come forward with proof that there was an intentional act or something other than something else that would take it out of the scope of one's authority.
Well, I know that the opportunity to go to the Texas Supreme Court to get issues resolved may not seem like much of a burden in some cases, but if the legislature intended to keep teachers out of the courtroom, this doesn't seem to accomplish that. It looks to me like it would be very easy to put your case in a position where you say it's over the line.
Well, respectfully, that's not what the legislature intended, because they could have written a statute that said no suit shall be filed. The trial courts do not have jurisdiction to hear such suits.
Let me ask you, would it make any difference? Does it make any difference that Collins talked to the press as opposed to somebody else?
Only to the extent that you can affirm or deny jurisdiction based on the fact that there was no evidence that that was Mr. Collins' job, or that that was within the scope of his employment.
No, but suppose he just reported to someone else that he thought there was a problem here. Suppose one teacher in a classroom reports to the principal that she thinks there's a problem in some other classroom. In your analysis, all of those situations, there might not be immunity.
Assuming that you get all over all the other hurdles of what defamation is and slander and libel and all those other damages, yes, I believe that intentional wrongdoing can be, but is not necessarily outside the scope of one's authority.
How about intentional infliction of emotional distress?
I think that falls under the same guidelines, and I believe that.
Do you have immunity or not?
No, it would not. If it was an intentional act, and prove all the elements and establish a genuine issue of material fact without discovery, as soon as the defendants file a motion, I believe that motion should be denied. Discovery should go forward, and the parties can then proceed to see whether there was really an act that was an intentional infliction of emotional distress. Respectfully, we talk about the public policy here. We're talking about our children. I would think and would hope that we place teachers and those in charge of our children with a higher burden, not with immunity. Now, there's a countervailing concern there.
But isn't that argument addressed across the street?
Absolutely.
But we didn't write the statute.
No, Your Honor, but I
can't. Whether it's a good policy or not, not up to us.
Absolutely. But I would hope to think that the legislator took into account, and I think they did, by not granting absolute immunity and by not saying courts don't even have jurisdiction to hear these cases.
But in the Tort Claims Act, for example, they specifically address intentional torts, do they not?
Yes, you
do. And they haven't done that here.
No, they have not. But that could go either way. One could argue that is because they don't want intentional torts to be covered, or that because intentional torts are not within the scope of one's appointment as a matter of law, as the Rosa H. case said. Rosa H. was a wrongful touching, a sexual harassment type case, or sexual molestation of a child. The court held under no means could that possibly be within the scope. Well, what happens if you're a doctor, or a school doctor, or a school nurse, or even a school trainer? Certainly you get within the scope of your job is to touch people or students that would otherwise be inappropriate if it wasn't in that context. Well, does that mean that a doctor or a nurse or trainer gets to sexually molest children? I think not.
Where do you draw the line, though? What kinds of cases would teachers be entitled to summary judgment on?
Respectfully, I don't know where you draw the line, but I do know that if you draw the fact of drawing the line, what is intentional and what is not for summary judgment adjudication. Intentional, you can't just say something is so extreme that it can't be within the confines of the scope of one's authority, because then you have to say, well, what's so extreme?
Well, it does seem like the position you're staking out does seem to undermine one of the key purposes, if not the primary purpose, of the statute, which is to keep teachers out of the courtroom.
Respectfully, I think the primary purpose is to get teachers out quickly if there's no reason for them to be in there, not to keep them out. It would have been very easy for the legislature to say, no jurisdiction. You cannot even file a lawsuit, should be summarily dismissed. What they said is, you need to jump over an initial hurdle of this, of immunity. And if you beat that hurdle, then move forward. And there's nothing preventing the district or these individuals from filing a summary judgment motion after discovery saying, you haven't met your burden. To say that, it's too difficult to draw a line saying, because the statute doesn't say, except in extreme circumstances. It says within the scope. Well, what is that test? Respectfully, the only possible test is the agency test, the restatement of agency, and all the other cases that address scope within the confines of employment.
Do you disagree with the chart the petitioners tried to draw up of the statutory and common law immunities under the Texas jurisprudence?
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to put it right.
Well, there's a chart.
I know the chart, and I think it's legally accurate.
All right, that's all I wanted to know. Yeah. So if we're trying to divine from other statutes what the legislature intended here, we can go to that as a shorthand reference.
I did not find anything wrong with that. Speaking to the Justice's questions as to what cases you have to overrule, there are a number of cases which, whether or not they find grant summary judgment or not grant summary judgment, at least implicate the issue of respondent superior and whether intentional torts can take something out of the scope of one's employment. Those include, but aren't limited to, the Bates case, Pearson, Chesser, which specifically adopts the restatement of agency, Stimson, Foster, Gallegos, and Rosa H., which specifically holds that sexual molestation of children certainly cannot be within the scope.
Well, is it your position then that although we have not ruled on this issue, that in fact the interpretation of the statute applying principles of agency to the definition of scope of duties is well established in the Court of Appeals?
Yes, sir.
And in fact, if we make this decision, we are going to be essentially effecting a change in the way this issue has been treated by the courts in Texas over a significant period of time?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, because I know that all the cases that I've been able to find that I think I'll speak directly to this point say in dicta, unless, of course, there's an intentional tort or words to that effect. And I think there aren't any cases that say if you have proof of an intentional tort,
right,
it's necessarily within the scope because the statute doesn't.
But my point is that because of the language in those cases and the number of cases that there are and the number of years, that it has been the practice, or at least it has been the assumption, that is the way this particular immunity provision works.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct.
Let me, just so I'm clear on this, Mr. Collins is an educational professional.
Yes, sir.
Your view is immunity would apply if, what, he was assigned officially to talk to the press? Or does the immunity apply if what he said to the press was true? Or what? Tell me specifically why it is you say the element that's missing from the affidavit that says he didn't establish that this was within his scope.
Because he doesn't establish that, this court has the power to deny, writ, and grant, and then say there is no jurisdiction, because it can simply affirm the lower court's ruling that there was no competent summary judgment evidence establishing that it was within his scope, regardless of what the statute was, because all there were conclusory allegations of I acted in the best interest of the ISD. Which, by the way, respectfully, points out another issue. Why is DISD and these folks submitting affidavits saying I was acting in the best interest of the ISD? If they're now saying that, well, whether I'm acting in the best interest or my purpose or my motive or intent is irrelevant. So they submitted affidavits, not just Mr. Collins, but other affidavits that say at all times we were acting in the best interest of the ISD. Mr. Collins says that.
The affidavit should say that I was assigned the task to talk to the press. I'm trying to figure out just what it is that the element that you say, well, it was within my scope of my duties, but I don't. It's a discretionary. Do you have the discretion to talk to the press? It seems to me it's the question. And so I don't reach the question of whether or not I was
My duty was to talk to the press. I looked to see if it's within my discretion to talk to the press. So is it because he failed to say that one of his discretionary duties was to determine whether or not to talk to the press, or it's not sufficient that I was asked to talk to the press by the media person? Or what is it you said was the minimum had to be in that affidavit to establish what you say was the scope?
The threshold would be not just a conclusory statement that it's my job or it's within the scope of my duties to talk to the press, but a little bit more, a written statement of his duties that was created before the lawsuit, a affirmation that that's what the normal practice is, some sort of rebuttable proof other than a self-serving allegation that that's my job.
Would you take a minute and address the jurisdictional question, please, and why you don't believe there's a conflict with Enrique or any of the other cases cited by the petitioner?
The cases cited by the petitioner fall into two categories. Number one, there are instances in which the plaintiff actually admits judicially in the pleadings or in deposition that the conduct was within the scope. Number two, they are negligent cases, non-intentional tort cases. I'm sorry, there is a third category. That would be where there's an allegation of intentional tort, but no proof of that at all. And that gets to your point, that you simply cannot allege an intentional tort and hope to get anywhere.
Well, the Williams case does not involve an intentional tort, but there's nothing in the analysis that showed the court cared one way or the other,
is it? I don't believe so. That's correct.
So why can't that establish a conflict if the analysis was critical to the court's resolution there, and that analysis was,
I don't think
was contrary to what the Court of Appeals did here?
I don't think that the court addressed the issue respectfully, and did not address it or specifically ruled on it. I don't think it's going to form the basis of conflict jurisdiction.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Judge Hankinson, if you'd add the Andrews versus Blankenship case to a case that is on our side, it's a Houston District Court case that's decided in the amicus brief. There, a baseball coach wrote a letter to the editors, and it's published in the paper, defaming another baseball coach, an intentional tort. And it was held that there was immunity and it applied. And on the last questions of the cases that we cited, we cited a number of cases, Enriquez among them, Anderson among them, that involve intentional torts, defamation, intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's involved here. It was involved in the Enriquez case, and the court held immunity because it looked to the purposes of the act.
Back to the conflicts question, and this is what continues to concern me, and this is a follow-up on Justice Hankinson's question. In the Court of Appeals opinion, they pose the issue that we're arguing here today. They pose what you're arguing. They pose what the issue that you're claiming about intentional and all the elements of proof. But what they conclude is, because of our analysis below, which is the insufficiency of the summary judgment proof, we do not reach the issue of whether the Education Code provides absolute immunity for any act of a school district professional employee.
But in that last paragraph there, they say, we'll assume that all they have all these general duties. We'll assume that they were where we say they would have been. And we'll assume that. But we're going to apply this extra requirements on the meeting respondeas superior type analysis. There is not, I forget who asked the question, but I do not believe there's one other case involving Education Code immunity where the court deliberately and emphatically cited only respondeat superior cases to make their point. They talk about within the scope in many of the cases that the counsel alluded to. We talk about within the scope of employment or like that, but that doesn't mean they're talking about agency law. They can be talking about this statute, which talks about scope.
But if the statute uses the word scope, why shouldn't we go to the restatement? Where else should we go?
Well, you could say let's go to. It doesn't say scope of employment. That's
scope
very
of their duties.
It says scope of their duties out of their employee's position or something like that. They draw it out. But you can go to Barnum and Taylor, Your Honor. That's where I think the legislature was coming from. That's a scope question. That's a scope case. And one of the little minor points made, we say best interest in the affidavits. Well, there was a discretionary judgment element that had to be met there. And we thought that would show that they were meeting that element by saying we thought we were trying to act in the best interest of the district.
Why is it that Collins didn't say that this was within the scope of his employment?
I think he did. I think he had to. He said what he did. The Lander affidavit says, I asked him to do that. I continuously asked people to do it. The Johnson affidavit says, we asked all to interrelate with the press. I mean, it's a stat. I don't know why Collins had to say it, but the rest of that section. It's there.
I'm sorry. Where is it you say in the affidavit proof that you asked all the that all the employees were asked to speak?
John Dollander says that you look at Robert Johnston's affidavit.
I just want to make sure I know what you're talking about. You agree that the attachments do not reflect that dealing with the media is part of the responsibilities of any of the people except the media director, Mr. Dollander?
No, ma'am. I'm not sure. I'm
just saying, do those documents specifically reference that part of their job is dealing with the media?
No.
Okay.
But with Mark Dollander and Hinkle, they would.
I understand. For Dollander,
They say, we ask these other people to relate to the press.
I just want to know about the job descriptions. So that I want to make sure I understand where you're coming from. So then if we don't find the job description speaking to the media in the attachments, where do we find that for all these people who provided their own affidavit proof, in which they make no mention of the fact that it was within their job duties to talk to the media, where do we find the proof that it was within their job?
In Dollander's affidavit.
In where?
Dollander. John Dollander's affidavit asked him to do it. You can go find it in the Fifth Circuit case of Henry Selkirk that we cite, which said in 1983 that Robbie Collins did not have to not respond to the press.
But all he did was ask Robbie Collins to speak to the press. He didn't ask anybody else to speak to the press.
He asked Robert Payton. Payton says he was asked by Dollander. Here's a guy that's coordinating the press, and he asks these people to help him out.
Is there anything else we should look at in the proof?
As far as the affidavit is concerned? Yes, ma'am. Look very carefully at the two affidavits presented by the respondents. That particularly, Matthew Harden did not say that Robbie Collins stepped right out of a room and said something that said the investigation was over when he didn't. He said he was surprised to learn that. That's the language in there. I was surprised to learn. Didn't say how he learned it. Didn't say where he learned it from. It's paragraph 9, page 3 there. Immediately after the meeting, Robbie Collins spoke with media personnel, period. I was surprised to learn. How did he learn it? The other question was in her affidavit, where she says, I heard it on the radio. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second clause. We'll take another brief recess.
Right.